And we've been talking about the Christian's worldview, the way that Christians process the information that they have, the way that that kind of the underlying suppositions that. Oh, yes. Thank you.
Recording in progress.
Okay. The Christian's worldview is a set of presuppositions that he brings to the table. It's the things that kind of form the framework that allows us to deal with information, allows us to file it away, and gives us a way to judge the information that we hear. If you don't have that, then you get just tossed around because the information is constantly changing. And because you don't have any set of set beliefs, kind of core beliefs, then everything that comes along, you get caught up in it. And we've talked about, just as we've been doing this with last week, we talked about the Christian and his understanding of technology. Technology can be used, but it's not a God. So tonight I'd like to talk about the Christian and his approach, or her approach, to science. And you have to understand what I think science is. Science is the way that we observe the world around us and codify what we're learning from observing the world around us. And then that knowledge from observation allows us to modify the world around us. Science is not a faith. It's not something that you believe without evidence. It's a belief that's based on evidence. And in many ways, it's very much like religion. We have a belief in God, and it's based on evidence. Scientists have a belief in other ideas that's based on evidence. They just discount the evidence that there is a God as they begin to do their scientific research very often. I think it's important that Christians understand that there are some very basic limitations to what we can learn from science. There are basic limitations to what we can learn from observing the world around us. And we can accept those. Those are not problems for us. They're just limitations to what we can observe with science. Now, as we observe the world around us, that doesn't contradict anything that God has ever said. The reasonable observation of the world around us corresponds perfectly to what God has revealed. There's just really one body of truth, and what is true and known from revelation is no different than what is true that is known from observation. So let's think about some of the limitations that observation has to deal with. Let's read Proverbs 27 at verse 1. Does somebody have that?
I do. Do not boast about tomorrow, for you do not know what a day may bring forth.
Okay. So how does that represent a limitation as far as observation is concerned?
Well, I don't know that this may sound dumb, but we can't observe with what we don't know, and we don't know what tomorrow brings.
There's nothing dumb about that at all, Eileen. That's the core of the issue. We can observe the past, and sometimes we make good observations of the past, and sometimes we observe something that went on in the past, but we don't know what it was. So we kind of make up a story that makes it seem like that makes sense. Years ago, Reader's Digest had it was a crazy little article about what archaeologists would think if they ever went into a motel from the 20th century. Now, we're talking about 25th century archaeologists who look at a motel that existed in the 20th century. And what might they conclude? And there were just really dumb things in there. Like, they would conclude that the toilet seat was some sort of ceremonial headdress that the priests would wear. They would put the seat over their head, and then the top part of the seat, you know, the seat part, I don't know what to call that, the top part of the seat would stand up behind their head, and that was some sort of ceremonial headdress. So, yeah, that makes some sense, I suppose, and sometimes that's the feeling that I get when people are looking at the past. We don't always make good decisions about what the past was like, but we for sure can't make decisions about what the future is going to be. Does anybody remember the comet Kohoutek? This was back in 1982, something like that. Kohoutek was going to pass at its closest point to Earth. Now, that, I mean, it's still way far away, but Kohoutek is going to pass at its closest point to Earth, and the astronomers were all saying this is going to be the brightest comet that we've ever seen. We're going to be able to see it. It'll be so bright that we'll be able to see it during the daylight hours. Oh, they went on and on. And they, you know, that was all based on their observing the path that Kohoutek was going to take, and looking at some of the indicators of how bright Kohoutek was. Kohoutek got here, and it was a flop. It was a real dud. Just couldn't find it in the night sky. It just wasn't what they thought it was going to be. So when we look at the future, it's a guess. It's an educated guess, but it's a guess. And when we look at the past, it's a story that we can tell about some things that we found. You know, we found a toilet seat. Well, what does a toilet seat do? 25th century archaeologists would make up a story about it. And that story, when it gets repeated over and over and over again, takes on a ring of truth. In many ways, that's like what was in science books when I was in school about the evolution of Eohippus, or the evolution of the horse. Everybody, you know, if you're as old as I am, you can remember that diagram where the horse started out really small and it just kept growing and growing and growing until eventually today we have a horse. It's been discredited. People say that the evidence that it was based on was faulty evidence. There are always limitations to observation. I have trouble knowing exactly what it is I've observed when I look at something that's happening today. Look at James 4, verse 14.
Yet you know not what your life will be like tomorrow. You are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away.
I'm not so much concerned about the second part of that, but what do you see in the first part of that?
Well, the uncertainty of our lives. I mean, we tend to think that I've gone to work every day for the last 20 years. We tend to think, okay, well, I'm going to work tomorrow. But, you know, anything can happen, and we don't know what it is. We're not in control.
Okay. Anybody else? I think you're right. That's basic probability. In my field, in statistics, it's called Bayesian probability. Sun came up yesterday. It came up the day before yesterday. It came up the day before that. And what do I expect is going to happen tomorrow? Bayesian probability says the sun's going to come up. And there's nothing wrong with using Bayesian probability and reasoning that way. We have to reason that way. But understand, it might not.
Well, and this might be a little off, but I'm sitting here now and I'm breathing just fine. I may not take another breath second from now. You know, it's not promised.
That's true. That's true. You think you're going to live tomorrow. And if I were a scientist looking at Carolyn, I would say that I'll schedule her to come in tomorrow and we'll do some tests and we'll learn something about Carolyn. Because I have every belief that Carolyn is going to be here tomorrow. And that's reasonable. But it's not an immutable truth. And scientists sometimes forget that that's just not an immutable truth. It not only applies to good things that we expect to happen tomorrow, but it applies to some evil things that we think may happen tomorrow. And we predict that it's just not going to be a suitable outcome. And tomorrow comes and seems like we get through it. That says something about worry as well, but our point tonight is to understand the limitation of science. Observation is good, but it's only good so far. How about Proverbs 16:33?
The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord.
What do you see there?
Well, that we will not be making the decision. And the Lord is going to do it for us, and hopefully it's what we like too.
Okay. Okay. Good point. Anybody familiar with the probability that when you flip a coin, you're going to get heads or tails? What's the probability if you flip a coin that you'll get heads or tails?
50%.
Right, 50-50. If I flip a coin and I want to predict whether it's going to be heads or tails. I would predict half the time it'll be heads, half the time it'll be tails. What's the probability if I flip a coin 100 times and it comes up heads 100 times? What's the probability that it'll come up heads the next time I flip the coin?
50%.
50-50. Okay. That just sounds weird. But that's the way it is. It's just 50%. Everybody's familiar with that good old normal curve. Remember, we like for our teachers to grade us on a curve. And what that means is that so many people are going to get A's, so many people are going to get B's, so many people get C's, so many D's, and so many F's. We don't think about that, but that's what that means. And you're familiar with that familiar bell shape that everybody knows about. I have a toy that my daughter gave me for Christmas. Best Christmas present ever. It has all of these little tiny ball bearings in it. And when you turn it over, they all drop through one of those plinker mazes, and they distribute across the bottom. And it always distributes into something that looks like that normal curve. But it has I can't think of how many little balls it has in there. I think it's about 1,000. And one of those balls is gold or gold colored. Do you know you can't make any prediction where that one ball is going to fall? You can predict overall it's going to be in the shape of a bell curve, but you can't predict anything about where that gold ball is going to be in that curve. You can say the probability is that it'll be in the middle. Probability is that it won't be out on one of the tails, but you can't make that observation. And, you know, I have made the argument before. I worked with the sex offender treatment program when I was living in Alaska. And the probability is that if you're convicted and jailed because of being a sex offender, you will do it again when you get out of jail. 98% of people do it again when they get out of jail. Does that mean that I can predict that X individual will do it again? Doesn't mean that at all. So when we talk about overwhelming statistics, but they really don't mean what sometimes we think they mean. Let's look at Proverbs 30. And this is kind of the answer to all of this. Verses 3 and 4 in Proverbs 30. I'll read that one. I have not learned wisdom, neither have I the knowledge of the Holy One, and that's God, who hath ascended up into heaven and descended, who hath gathered the wind in his fists, who hath found the waters in his garment, who has established all the ends of the earth. What is his name? What is his son's name, if you know? There are some things that I can't observe. What can you think of that I cannot observe? Nobody can observe, no matter how sophisticated their observation tools are. You cannot observe it.
The wind itself, you can see the effects of it, but not the wind itself.
Okay. Sometimes you're right. Sometimes we put the cause or the effect for the cause. What else?
Time.
Say again.
Time, like in the effects of like growth over time for some things.
Okay. We can make some predictions about that, but statistical predictions. But yeah, good point. Time is a very difficult thing to measure.
See, sound.
Sound? Is that what you're saying, Anne?
Yes, you cannot see sound.
Okay. Sound is kind of difficult to measure. We don't know exactly how it works. I was thinking a little bit differently. I was thinking about things that we'll never be able to measure. You know, what?
I thought you said to see, Dean.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I said, I thought you said to see.
Okay. You're right. Things that are difficult to see. Things that are difficult to, and I should apologize. I fall back on what can we measure, what can we not measure. Go ahead, Carol.
You can't measure the kindness or the love that's in somebody's heart.
No, that's true. That's true. We measure, again, we put the effect for the cause. That's true. What I was thinking of is the utter impossibility of observing anything that happens after death. It's like to a person who's making observations, we get to the point of death, and beyond that, for you and me, it's a black hole. What happens to your soul? What happens to you at the point of death? And the scientist, because it can't be measured, because it can't be observed, says nothing. That's it. Nothing happens after death. That's because we can't measure it. We cannot observe it. Who has ascended up into heaven and descended? None of us have been there. There are a few people that were dead who came back to life. But we cannot measure what happens after death. You're going to have to rely on some sort of revelation from somebody who's done that to tell you about it. And scientists hate that very idea. So let's think about a little bit about some of the problems that we can't resolve with science. And we resolve a lot of issues with science. I mean, think about, well, what we've just been through with the pandemic and trying to find some sort of way to understand what was going on, how bad it would have been to have lived hundreds of years ago when you thought that everything that happened because of vapors or different kinds of just I don't even know what to call it, but people died during the Civil War because they put their privies upstream from their drinking water. We've solved that problem. We understand you don't do that because microbes migrate from your privy into your drinking water, and then you drink those microbes. You just don't do that. We've solved a lot of problems. We learned how to deal with viruses, and we've learned how to inoculate ourselves or vaccinate ourselves. So many things that we've learned. But there are some problems that we cannot solve. It's just intractable. John 12 at verse 8.
I can read that.
Go ahead.
For the poor you have with you always, but me you do not have always.
First part of that, the poor you have with you always. Would it be nice to be able to solve the homeless problem? I wish that we could find a way to solve that problem. But I don't think science is going to tell us how to do that. We've had all this time to try to figure out some way to solve the homeless problem. And essentially what's happened is we stopped measuring whether we've solved the homeless problem. Now, instead of measuring the number of people that are homeless, we measure the amount of money that we've spent trying to solve the homeless problem. That's not the same thing. Or we measure the intentions of people to solve the homeless problem. Science is not going to get us there. If anybody knows the magic pill to solve the homeless problem, pass it on to the people that are policymakers, because there's just, it seems like every 5 years or so, we have a different approach to the homeless problem. And homelessness is just growing. We're not resolving the problem. We're not resolving questions of poverty. Now, I have to say, science has largely discovered some things that there's an essential way to prevent a great deal of poverty. It's the path that you're supposed to follow. Finish high school. Don't get married until you finish high school, and then get married. And don't have children before you get married. And after you get married, have children. There's one other step that they didn't include. Stay married. That'll deal with a lot of poverty. That's a biblical approach. That'll deal with a lot of poverty. Science has been able to kind of ferret that out by just looking at the people who fall into poverty and those who don't.
And it all goes back to God and His wisdom.
Oh, that's true.
Especially these scientists. I mean, He's the one who guides them.
That's true.
You know?
That's true.
In the Bible, guiding us all if we pay any attention to it.
And if we would pay attention to what observation tells us and not approach it with a preconception, we can learn a lot from observation. But yeah, go ahead.
Don't you think that there are two types of people, at least two types of people with poverty? There's a person who has something traumatic that happens, the loss of a job, something traumatic, spouse, you know, a breakup, you know, something along that line. And then there seems to be an awful lot of people in our society now who just say it's easier to just give up and take whatever anybody's willing to give me. I'm just not willing to do anything. It's too much.
Good observation. And that in some ways is the difference between poverty and laziness. But science is never going to solve that problem.
I think there's another category that we deal with homelessness in our generation. And I kind of gather this from working in a city that had a high homeless rate. And that's mental illness. And so that's probably the majority of the homelessness. There's certainly a group of people who have addiction problems, have other kinds of problems, and as Carol mentioned, and then there are certainly people who are just taking advantage of the social services that are in place. But we can't forget it's a very multi-layered, difficult problem. I mean, it's a good example that you're using, Dean, but it's definitely a very, very complicated issue to deal with. And I like, you know, Jesus is right. We will always have the poor. So it doesn't matter what cultural structure you have or governmental structure you have, if you're a democracy, if you're not, it doesn't matter. You are always going to have poor people, middle class people, and rich people. So you will always have the poor. And so what did he mean by that? He's saying you're going to have time to care for them. There will be, he's not saying don't take care of them. There will be time to do that. Anyway, so I didn't want to get off on that too much, but I think you're right. It's how we measure it and how we deal with it as a society.
Right. Right.
Well, and I was thinking, it seems to me there were beggars and such back in Jesus' time.
True.
You know?
True, and there were people who like we were discussing this morning in John 5, that were paralyzed from their youth and could not work, and they relied on alms. And there were people in Jesus' day who were demon possessed, and there were other people who were just simply mentally ill. It's not enough to say that it's a complex problem. We're not going to resolve that issue. Science is just not gonna get it. So let's look at Proverbs 27 and verse 20. And again, I'm kind of interested in the last part of this verse.
Nor are the eyes of man ever satisfied.
Okay. Is there a point at which a person looks at his life and says, I have enough? Science should be able to find that. Observation should be able to tell us that. But we haven't found a way to determine what that is. What is it about people that makes us desire sometimes more than what we need? You know, I was reading just within the last couple of days that I can see his face. and now I can't recall his name, started Microsoft, Bill Gates. I guess Bill Gates, some of his neighbors are complaining that he's just a real jerk. And he's one of those people that has so much money that he gives loans to God. You know, the guy, I shouldn't say that. He has so much money, he can't find a way to spend all of the money that he has. And he's a jerk, at least in the eyes of some people. It amazes me that we always want more. Let's look at Proverbs 30. And let's look at verse 11. I have a number of other passages that are listed there that kind of talk about the same thing. Proverbs 30 verses 15 and 16 and Hebrews 2 at verse 15 all kind of talks about the same thing. Let's go on. Proverbs 30. Can I get somebody to read verses 11 through 14?
I can read that. There is a generation that curses its father and does not bless its mother. There is a generation that is pure in its own eyes, yet it is not washed from its filthiness. There is a generation, oh, how lofty are their eyes, and their eyelids are lifted up. There is a generation whose teeth are like swords, and whose fangs are like knives, to devour the poor from off the earth, and the needy from among men.
Anybody have an observation about that passage? What's it saying? We can't resolve.
They're trying to be problem solvers, but the more and more they try to solve problems, the more I guess evil they become. It's kind of what I'm drawing.
Yeah, how do you, good observation, Matt. How do you deal with hate? Where does hate come from? And if this is what he's talking, how would a person ever not be grateful to their mother for giving them birth?
Abuse.
Yeah, but even abuse. Okay, yeah. Didn't think about that. Good point, Carol.
Just self-centeredness. You just, people with that mentality of, oh, I could have done it better, or my parents messed me up by doing this and that and whatever, and they have all the answers, but most of the time when you look at that self-centeredness, they've done nothing. Or everything they've done is for themselves.
Right. Right. I was thinking along the lines that you are, Matt, when I was reading this. I didn't think about what Carol pointed out, that I guess someone would not be grateful to their mother if their mother abused them. But then it makes me think, how do you account for a mother that abuses its child or her child? That's what's described in the book of Romans as being without natural affection. Natural affection, the best illustration of that is the love that a mother naturally feels for her child. And something that happens when a woman gives birth. There is an attachment there that just goes beyond what we can imagine. How could somebody break that attachment? And you know, I was reading just this week that a bill was introduced in the legislature in California. Now, the fact that a bill is introduced in the legislature doesn't mean a whole lot, but there are some things that you would just think are beyond the pale. There was a bill introduced in the legislature in California that if you are a mother who gives birth, you have the unqualified right to cause your child to die by not caring for your child, and you will not be prosecuted for the first 28 days. It has always amazed me that we could wantonly kill a child up to the point of birth. But it goes beyond the pale to say that a mother has the right to let her child die for 28 days after birth.
Satan's taking over.
Well, I have to say, I can't explain that.
I think Anne's on the money.
Yeah. I think that's probably true. The whole question of abortion and the individual right to kill another human being, it is beyond me. It's what science brings us to.
It's just inconceivable that anyone could even come up with a law like that. I just can't. It's hard to even wrap my mind around it.
I'm like you, Carolyn. It's not a law. It's just a bill that was introduced in the legislature. And no doubt this thing won't go anywhere. I can't imagine that even a liberal state like California would pass a law like that. And that the governor, as much as I can't understand Governor Newsom, I can't imagine that he would even sign such a bill or such a law into effect. But I'm like Carolyn, the fact that somebody even introduced the idea is beyond what I can understand.
In Amsterdam, I think it's Amsterdam, it's in Holland anyway, they put a law through that said that homosexuals can marry boys as young as 16, and they tried to get it down to the age of 12. So, I mean, it's the ruling of who's ever in control in a land or a city.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't think science has an answer for that. I just don't think science can answer those questions. You would think that people would say science is showing that a fetus, I think it's 12 at 12 weeks feels pain or responds to painful stimuli. It may be even earlier than that. We're learning to measure those kinds of things. But even at that, science can't solve that problem. And there's no question that science is never going to deal with the problem of guilt. There is no answer from science that makes guilt go away. A lot of people that follow science as the be-all and end-all just simply deny that guilt ever happens. And that's not true. Guilt happens. We even define those people that don't feel guilt as being psychopaths. I was watching a television show last night after Kim went to bed on serial killers. She won't let me watch those kinds of shows when she's awake. But I was watching this show on serial killers, and there was a guy on there that was describing how he decided to kill his mother. And he exhibited no kind of guilt at all for what he had done. And the scientist said, the psychologist said, he's clearly a psychopath. He is clearly somebody who is outside the norm. We can't help him. We can't deal with him. So guilt is just beyond what science can give us. Science gives us a lot of things, and there's nothing wrong with science. There's nothing wrong with observation. There's nothing wrong with trying to figure out how things work by looking at the world around us. Just recognize the limitations. Now, here's the crux of the issue. What are the dangers that attend to being able to make scientific advancements? Let's look at Daniel, the fourth chapter. And I want to start here in verse 28. This is, it seems to me, something that we just have to learn to acknowledge. Daniel 4, I'll read that one, starting at verse 28. All this came upon the king Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of 12 months, he was walking in the royal palace of Babylon. The king spake, and he said, "Is not this great Babylon, which I have built for the royal dwelling place by might of my power and for the glory of my majesty?" What does great accomplishment do? No doubt Babylon, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon were one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. It was no doubt it was beautiful. We even find some remains that indicate how extensive it was. It was beautiful. But all of the science that he used to build those gardens and his ability to irrigate the desert was, in fact, just marvelous. It is all for naught. We sometimes think that scientific advancements are the ultimate thing for which we ought to strive. And that's not the case. Let's look at Luke 12. it's a similar kind of understanding. Let's start in Luke 12 at verse 54. And we'll read down through verse 57.
Then he also said to the multitudes, whenever you see a cloud rising out of the west, immediately you say, the shower is coming, and so it is. And when you see the south wind blow, you say, there will be hot weather, and there is. Hypocrites, you can discern the face of the sky and of the earth, but how is it you do not discern this time? Yes, and why even of yourselves do you not judge what is right?
I think that's the, in my mind, that's the ultimate problem. We make scientific advancements, and we can predict the weather, at least to a certain extent, and we're fairly good at it. But Romans says that sometimes we suppress the truth in ungodliness. We do not like to retain God in our knowledge. We suppress the truth. There's every indication in the world that the best way to raise children is in a intact family, mom and dad, who love each other and who work to provide for their kids. And if you make that point on television or the radio, you will be canceled in our culture. You're not allowed to make that point. That the best way to raise kids is in an intact family where mom and dad work together to support their kids. Because somebody will argue, well, all of a sudden you've said that we can't have homosexual couples who are committed to each other and they want to raise kids, and you're saying that they're less. Yes, that's pretty much what I'm saying. But you'll be canceled if you say that. And the evidence is really very clear. Even science concludes that that's the evidence. But we've decided that that's not what we want the evidence to say. And so we just deny it. We beat it down. That's the danger. Not that science can't figure out things. The danger is that we just won't accept the evidence.